for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Europe backs a debt rescue package for Greece. Two former Murdoch executives dispute testimony in Britain's phone hacking scandal. Syria threatens to expel the U.S. ambassador. Millions are at risk from drought and famine in East Africa. And news comes in of an explosion in the Norwegian capital, Oslo. Here in the studio with me for the international stories on the Friday News Roundup, Moises Naim of El País, Elizabeth Buemiller of the New York Times, and Tom Jelton of NPR. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook or Twitter. Maury, I can't even talk. I'm so upset about this Oslo explosion. What do we know, Moises?
We know very little, Diane. We know that there was an explosion at the government headquarters in Oslo, that one person is dead and eight have been injured, that no one has taken responsibility for it, that at the time the Prime Minister Jens Stoltenberg was having lunch elsewhere and that he's safe, and we are just awaiting for more information.
Tom.
Well, one thing to keep in mind, Diane, is that after Osama bin Laden was killed, the new number two in al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri, is said by U.S. officials to have argued in favor of attacking targets outside the United States but linked to U.S. allies. And there has been, ever since, a very high level of anxiety and threat concern about targets in Europe. Now, we don't know, as Moises said, we don't know who's responsible for this or whether al-Qaeda would even claim to any responsibility, but that connection is one that we need to keep in mind.
Elizabeth.
We also know from the Abbottabad raid on bin Laden's complex in May that there was a big divide in al-Qaeda between bin Laden, who was obsessed with the United States and attacks here, and his some of his lieutenants who felt that it was just easier to attack other countries because there were less security issues. And again, we don't know who this is, but this would be interesting if that were the case. Also, there was a lot of talk that Zawahiri was interested in attacking in Egypt. But Norway, you don't always think of as a country.
You really
that
don't.
Would,
yeah. Do you think we will know eventually who did this?
Well, I think that the forensics on a big explosion like this are such that I think that we certainly will know more than we do today. I mean, certainly we're going to find out how this happened. Whether we can trace it back to some individual organization is another question.
All right, let's talk about Greece. Tom Jelton, what is the plan that's been agreed to?
Diane, there will be the short answer to that is that the Europeans are basically creating kind of their own version of the IMF, which will be a fund that will have a lot of the functions and powers that the IMF has now around the world to come to the aid of beleaguered governments. This will be for governments in Europe that face this kind of monetary fiscal crisis. There is a big bailout of Greece in the short term, and more importantly, what some bankers would call a default, because some of the bonds, Greek bonds, are being extended. Short-term bonds are being converted into long-term bonds. That means that creditors that expected to be paid in the short term will now have to wait for the long term. That is technically a type of default. So for the first time, private banks that hold Greek bonds are going to pay a little bit of a price for having bought those bonds from a country that clearly was not a good fiscal bet.
But does this solve the long-range problem for Greece and for the euro?
It depends how the markets react, and we still don't know that. But what's very interesting is to answer the question, why now? Why is it that yesterday they decided on a plan that was already being discussed and debated months ago and that was constantly rejected by Angela Merkel and others? So the ideas that were eventually approved have been around, and they were patterned after the Brady plan that was applied in Latin America, that situation and that defaults of the 1990s. The why now is Italy. The why now is that last week there was a huge run against Italy, and there was the scare that it could escalate and take also Spain. Those are two huge economies that could not be bailed out. If there was a strong run and therefore in a crash on Italy and Spain, there was no bailing out. And that is what made those that were rejecting the ideas in the past to accept it. And those include Angela Merkel and include some powerful banking lobbies and others that now had to accept their reality.
Let me ask you something. Has the world gone mad in terms of spending? Is that why we're seeing all these crises all over the world, Tom?
You know, there's this interesting concept, Diane, called moral hazard, which has really come to the forefront, first in 2008 and right on down to now. And that is that lenders have been loaning money without taking into consideration risk. And there has been, up until now, really no punishment for lenders who make bad loans. And that creates this situation called moral hazard, where there's really no downside to making bad loans. Now the world is paying the price for that over a number of years, and it's not clear whether the world has really learned a lesson, because right now, for example, in the case of Greece, what we're going to see in the next few months is whether private banks continue to buy bonds of the Italian government bonds, Spanish government bonds, Portuguese government bonds, or will they now be far more cautious about financing those government debts? If they are too cautious, then those governments are going to have trouble financing their budgets, and that could set in motion another whole chain of crises. It's really a very nervous time.
It's important to, in terms of your question, has the world gone mad concerning borrowing and spending and all that? Let's remember that we are still recovering from a very deep financial catastrophe that took place several years ago, and that we are still cleaning that mess, both here in the United States and in Europe. And so it's important not to forget that we are just dealing with mistakes that were made almost a decade ago.
Let me. I have a question for my esteemed colleagues here. At the Pentagon, we don't spend too much time on the Greek crisis, but I have a question. Who is going to pay for this in the long run? Is it the French taxpayers, the German taxpayers? I mean, who is going to help shore up these banks in Europe?
At this point, the Greek population is already suffering, and throughout the world, you are seeing government services being cut. In England, you have seen some draconian cuts, and that are affecting everyone. You can see the same happening in Spain, and so there is a tension between the need for government spending to create employment and growth, and the need to cut government spending in order to deal with the deficit. That is a thorny dilemma that has no easy solution.
And one we face even in this country at the same time. All right, let's move on to a subject about which you, Elizabeth, know a great deal. We have a new commander in Afghanistan. General Petraeus handed over command of U.S. and NATO-led troops on Monday to U.S. Marine Corps General John Allen. What kind of difference could that make?
Well, the difference is on the ground and in the White House plan for withdrawal. General Allen is going to be presiding over the drawdown of 100,000 American troops in Afghanistan. The difference is that Petraeus presided over the surge. He presided over the buildup of forces, and he also presided over what most people agree is a military success in southern Afghanistan. There is no question that the U.S. forces did, you know, tamp down violence in Helmand and Kandahar provinces in the south. The question is, what happens when those forces leave? And nobody knows. Right now, there was, in the past week, there was the beginning of a handover, somewhat symbolic, to the Afghan forces in seven places in Afghanistan that are largely stable: Mazar-e-Sharif in the north, Herat, parts of Kabul, Lashkargah, the capital of Helmand province. And that's expected to not make a huge difference because those places were largely doing okay, relatively speaking. And so, but in the next year, General Allen faces a big task, which is by the end of 2012, there's going to be 30,000 less American troops in Afghanistan. That's a third of what's there now, and the Afghan security forces are going to have to step in, and they're doing better, but no one thinks that they're ready.
You know, Diane, no American general wants to preside over the loss of a war or see previously achieved gains eroded. And so I think, in line with what Elizabeth said, I think that one of the tasks that General Allen faces is how does he preserve these gains with fewer troops? And I think one of the things that we are likely to see, we know that General Petraeus and other American commanders argued against this particular schedule of withdrawing troops. So I think we may see efforts to kind of finesse this withdrawal a little bit. Mm-hmm. So you may see, for example, non-combat personnel being replaced by combat personnel so that the number of trigger pullers, as they say, stays the same.
Tom Gelton, correspondent for NPR and author of Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, the biography of a cause. Short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Guests here in the studio, Elizabeth Buemiller of the New York Times, Moises Naim of El País, and Tom Gelton of NPR. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Moises, what have we heard about Pakistan's military trying to influence U.S. policy?
We have, there have been a report that there is an entity called the Kashmiri American Council that has been spending up to $4 million in contributions to members of Congress and other political campaigns. It turns out that the Kashmiri American Council is accused of being a front for the Pakistani spy agency. As we know, Kashmir is a Muslim region divided between India and Pakistan and is claimed as territory by both countries, and the two nations have fought three wars over that region since 1947. So this entity, the executive director is Syed Ghulam Nabi, and Zahir Ahmad is another member of that organization. They're both U.S. citizens, and they have been actively trying to induce members of the U.S. Congress to support the Kashmiri side of the
But Elizabeth, the Pakistani. If in fact they are acting in coordination, let's say, with the ISI, isn't there a law against foreign governments playing any role, making any contributions to U.S. elections?
Yes, that's why the FBI announced an investigation this week, a 43-page affidavit on charges that they did this. I would just like to say that as a I used to live in India and used to go to Kashmir many times back when you could go to Kashmir. I think this was perhaps $4 million that was not well spent by the ISI, the Director of Inter-Services Intelligence, Pakistan's powerful spy agency, and the Pakistani military, because I don't think through two they were doing this over 20 years, they're alleged to have done this, and through a number of administrations, Republican and Democratic, nobody, the administration did not budge on this issue, which is that this was up to the Indians and the Pakistanis and the Kashmiris to decide for themselves, and U.S. policy has shown no noticeable change. Now, this doesn't stop us from saying this shouldn't have been happening, but as the FBI alleges, but that's the upshot of this. India has a powerful lobby here as well, but presumably everyone's registered.
Certainly puts another little strain on U.S.-Pakistani relations.
Well, you know, from Pakistan's point of view, there can't be any coincidence that these incidents just pile up one right after another, although it does appear to be a coincidence. I mean, you had the Abbottabad raid where the Pakistani military was not informed in advance that this was going to happen and was caught flat-footed. You've had, even since then, an even a higher number of drone strikes in Pakistani territory than we had seen before. That also outraged a lot of Pakistanis. And now we have this accusation against the Pakistani intelligence agency. And in fact, what the FBI is saying is that these contributions were made and that the ISI actually reimbursed the individuals who were making the contributions. So the money came from the intelligence service. And the Pakistani government, the Pakistani authorities are outraged by this, and they do see it as part of this campaign against Pakistan right now.
Against Pakistan. And yet, what's happened to this postponement of the $800 million in aid that the U.S. had promised to Pakistan?
As you said, Diane, this is just part, one more item in a long list of frictions and disagreements between Pakistan and the United States in recent months. It started, as Tom said, with the raid that took Osama bin Laden out, continued with all sorts of accusations and with the drones, then with the United States deciding to postpone $800 million of military aid to Pakistan, and Pakistan then kicking out 100 military advisors, U.S. military advisors. So the situation cannot be worse. There are misunderstandings. There are clearly contrasting interests and clashing visions of what needs to be done. And this is a very important relationship. Let's not forget what Pakistan means in terms of Afghanistan. Let's not forget that it's a nuclear power and it's a very, very unstable, politically unstable country divided by many different factions.
I would just add on, I agree with all of this, but on the drone strikes, which have stepped up markedly in Pakistan since the summer of 2008 and have, by many estimates, killed close to 2,000 people, high-value targets, as the CIA calls them. This is allegedly covert program. I think that the Pakistanis, you're absolutely right, complain quite bitterly about these strikes. But behind closed doors, there is more acquiescence among the leadership about these drone strikes because they are, after all, going after insurgents in Pakistan. But it's a mixed message you get, and it's but there's no indication that the U.S. is going to stop those drone strikes anytime soon.
And meanwhile, you've got this video released by the Taliban insurgents of killing 16 Pakistani men, Tom.
Yeah, there's a video of 16 Pakistanis who are believed to have been, I can't recall what exactly the Taliban had against them. They were like enemies of the Taliban for one reason or another. And the video showed them lined up, and then they went and executed them and then went back and sort of finished anyone off that was showing signs of life. obviously an extremely horrific, brutal video, but the Taliban seems to sort of use this tactic to intimidate people. I mean, this is not the first time that they have released videos showing really horrific things, and I think the point of it is to really intimidate people and to frighten them into submission.
And even more shootings today in Karachi, another 8 people killed. Wounded, 18, more than 100 people dead in the last month.
And as Elizabeth was saying, this is a complex relationship that's full of mixed messages, contradictions, and misinformation, and so on. And that is a function of the fact that the country itself is highly fragmented. So when you have at the same time the notion that some in Pakistan bitterly denouncing the attacks by the drones, and at the same time under the table asking for more, that just shows that they are internally divided, that there are factions inside the Pakistani state that include the government and the intelligence agencies and other operatives that have just different interests and different views, and that is reflected in a variety of ways in which they relate to the United States.
You know, one story we have not focused enough attention on is this drought in East Africa, this horrible drought, which it's apparently the worst drought in 60 years, has left 11 million people seeking food and assistance, Tom.
Yeah, in Somalia, Ethiopia, and Kenya, 4 million in Somalia alone. And the great tragedy of this is that it comes on top of the civil war in Somalia, which not only aggravates the suffering, but it makes it much more difficult for relief agencies to get in there and provide food to these people. Relief agencies are very careful in using the word famine to describe a condition. They're actually, I learned just in reading about this, that there's actually a formal definition for what constitutes a famine. It requires 2 adults or 4 children to die out of 10,000 to die each day, and that standard has been met in this area. But again, the problem is that much of Somalia, particularly South Somalia, is controlled by this Al-Qaeda-affiliated militant Islamist group, Al-Shabaab. And if you didn't have enough reason to not like Al-Shabaab, just take a look at the way that they have been dealing with this. Not only have they been obstructing relief supplies from getting into that area, they have actually come out and said that the world is exaggerating the severity of the suffering. And if you've seen any of the pictures of children or people, and as you say, the number of refugees on the run, you know, to think that anyone is exaggerating the severity of this is just outrageous.
Elizabeth.
Well, as Jeffrey Gettleman has reported in my paper, the same militants who forced the Western aid organizations out of Somalia last year, right as the drought was looming, are now urging them to come back. But obviously these aid officials are wary of this because of the dozens of workers who've been killed in Somalia in recent years. And also there are American government rules that prohibit material support to the militants, who demand taxes, as they say, for allowing the deliveries to pass through.
Moises.
This is indeed a tragedy. Ban Ki-moon, the UN General Secretary, is asking for a strong, effective, immediate action. He's asking for about $1.6 billion of aid. And it's a horrible tragedy, and looking at the images is really heart-wrenching. However, to provide a little bit of context, it's very interesting to see how this Somalia famine illustrates or is a function of very interesting, dangerous new global trends. This is a function also of rising food prices. This famine has to do with the fact that all sorts of food staples are more expensive, which in turn is due to the fact that there is more demand, especially in Asia, in India,
and
China.
And there's no rain.
And then this is also related to climate change, which is another global trend. It is related, as Elizabeth and Tom were saying, with the fact that there is Somalia is a failed state, that Al-Qaeda is there, which is another large trend. And then it is also related to the fact that Somalia is a failed state. It has been for a long time. This has happened before. Now is happening with far more intensity and gravity. But it's a snapshot of it concentrates and illuminates very important global trends that are beyond what's going on.
So, to what extent can the UN get in there and really offer some assistance, Tom?
Well, we're going to see that in the next few days. As Marseille said, the UN is, or Ban Ki-moon has called for, you know, special urgent meetings to figure out a strategy. I think it largely depends on, you know, what the leadership of al-Shabaab decides is in their interest, you know, and if they want to obstruct this, they can obstruct it. If they see it in their interest to allow this aid to come in, you know, it'll happen. But it's a very risky operation. As Elizabeth said, I think something like 14 aid workers have been killed there in recent years who were doing nothing other than trying to provide relief to the people, but they are seen as Westerners, you know, in a region where anyone who's a Westerner is considered an enemy.
And NBC did show pictures of these poor children, their parents, walking miles, walking for a month at a time, without food, without any sort of help or assistance, and asking the American people once again to help out. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's talk about Rupert Murdoch and his son, who testified before a committee of the British Parliament about phone hacking charges against News Corp. Rupert Murdoch apologized. James Murdoch said the hacking was limited to a lone rogue reporter. That doesn't quite seem to be that way, Elizabeth.
Well, it just in the last day, two former News International executives have publicly contradicted James Murdoch, his testimony to the Parliament, and said that, in fact, they told him of evidence in 2008 that suggested that phone hacking at the company was one of the company's tabloids was far more widespread. So you've got a he said situation.
Somebody else said, yeah.
And you know, and James Murdoch has stuck to his testimony, saying, "I was truthful." They have said he was, quote, mistaken. So we'll see where this plays out. Interestingly, this morning there are reports in the Wall Street Journal, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch on this side of the Atlantic, that the Justice Department is pressing for subpoenas as part of a preliminary investigation into News Corp relating to the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which would be an interesting way of applying that law, because usually that law is used against companies that try to bribe foreign officials by giving them business contracts. But they're nonetheless proceeding forward. There's also an FBI investigation, very preliminary, into whether, I'm sure this has been discussed earlier on the show, about whether or not the cell phones of the 9/11 victims here in this country were hacked into. There's no evidence.
Allegations only.
Right. You know, the other, we're dealing with international politics in this hour, Diane, and the other interesting aspect of this case is what does it mean for British Prime Minister David Cameron, who cut short a trip to Africa to come back to speak before Parliament on this issue, because he's been very closely linked, not only socially to a number of these characters, but Andy Coulson, who's one of the former editors who is now under arrest, was a top communications aide to David Cameron. And there was even some concern on the part of the Cameron's people that his government could be jeopardized as a result of this crisis. And that was the context for his appearance before Parliament. And I think the key question was how the Liberals, who are the junior partner in his coalition, were going to react to this. And it appears for now that they are turning their anger on the kind of the tabloid powers and culture in Britain rather than on Cameron himself. So he apparently has come through, at least this week, intact in terms of his government, but he has been seriously tainted by these allegations.
Tommy is right. That's a good summary of what went on. The only thing that can be added is that Cameron, in his defense, said that all these abuses by the News of the World and the tabloids took place when the Labour government was in power. It was during the time when Tony Blair and Gordon Brown were prime ministers, and they also had close links with the Murdochs and News International. And therefore, this seems to, you know, his argument is this transcends just his own party and his own personal links with Rebecca Brooks and others in News International.
We've now had word that there are two dead in what is described as the Oslo bombing. Also, an email from a listener, Murdoch controls 70%. Of Australian news outlets. When this type of consolidation takes place, it puts politicians into vulnerable positions and promotes the owner's personal beliefs. We're headed the same way in the USA. Short break, and when we come back, we'll open the phones.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness on the web at melvilletrust.org, by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth on the web at aecf.org, and by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
If the only kind of ants you encounter are the ones that might invade your picnic, consider yourself lucky. On the next Fresh Air, explorer and biologist Mark Moffat tells us about the army ants, which swarm and overwhelm prey many, many times their size.
Their capacity for destruction is immense. That's why you do not tie up your cattle in Africa.
Join us.
And it's time to open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Adam in Austin, Texas. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I've got two questions. My first question is in regards to the debt crisis in Greece. What effect will the Greek debt crisis have on the United States, if any, positive or negative? And the second question is, if Pakistan was found to be harboring bin Laden, what are U.S.'s options in dealing with Pakistan? And I'll take my answers off the air.
All right, sir. Greek crisis effects on U.S., Tom.
You know, Diane, I was at a meeting yesterday at the Peterson Institute of International Economics here in Washington, which is the leading think tank on these international economic issues. And the head of the institute asked his very distinguished panel this precise question: what is going to be the effect on the United States? And you know what? Nobody knew. They said, we just don't know yet. It is, you know, this could yet sort of take on many different directions. We just don't know yet what the effect is going to be in the United States.
Do you agree with that?
I agree. We don't know, but we do know that we're better off today than we were yesterday. We are better off because of this deal. It creates a modicum of stability that we didn't have in the past week.
All right.
These are good news. Let's see what happens.
And what about Pakistan's harboring bin Laden relations between the U.S.?
Well, Pakistan, to some degree, was harboring bin Laden. I mean, the question is who knew, and that's the question that U.S. policymakers and the defense secretary have asked repeatedly. Robert Gates, as he was leaving the Office of Defense Secretary, said, you know, somebody knew in Pakistan, whether it was retired military, low-level ISI, we don't know. The question is the good one. What happens if the U.S. finds out and has evidence? There's been none so far. That someone fairly senior in the Pakistani military or in the Pakistani government knew, what is the recourse then? I don't have an answer for that. Obviously, I suspect the U.S. would try to leverage that in some way. We're not going to go to war with Pakistan, but there would be some try to leverage that and try to get Pakistan to do more what the U.S. wants. I don't see any great hope of that, but that's all. This is all speculation on my part.
All right. To Dayton, Ohio. Ibrahim, you're on the air.
Thank you so much, Dan. I appreciate the chance to talk. I'm a Syrian-American physician, and I'm talking about the unrest in Syria. You know, I have been actually in Syria about 3 months ago, and I've seen it with my own eyes. I don't need any official media or those who claim to be really unbiased media sources. I have seen how Syria, which was until the unrest, second to none in peace, in hospitality and intolerance, where I myself enjoyed. I don't have brothers or sisters, but I have so many brothers from different Muslim sects, different Christian sects, Armenian and Orthodox, even Jewish. We lived all in harmony, and until this unrest, which started okay. You know, the majority of the people were really thrilled that we have peaceful protesters initially. However, I'm so tense now. Until those extremists try to hijack this peaceful, democratic, actually, you know, requiring democracy in Syria. And now we fell into, like, chaos. And what bothered me now is that our ambassador, who is really, we were thrilled in Syria that we have Ambassador Ford there, who's really going back to the old administration mistakes in which, you know, as the saying says, those who cannot learn from history are doomed to repeat it. And unfortunately, Mr. Ford is going and supporting those areas which the extremist. And really, I'm bothered that my tax money, when we are $14 trillion in the hole, that goes to support such kind of people. You know, we want democracy, we want freedom, but you know, we don't want to support extremists. We don't want to turn Syria into like Somalia.
Now, let me understand, Ibrahim. You're talking about the visit of U.S. Ambassador Robert Ford to the protesters in the flashpoint city of Hama on July 7th and 8th, and that's what you're speaking in regard to, and you feel that was a mistake on the part of the U.S.
You're absolutely right.
All right, Tom.
Well, you know, it's a little hard for us to know exactly who is behind this massive protest movement in Syria. Ibrahim thinks that extremists are behind it, and there may very well be extremists. We know, for example, that some of the Sunni insurgents in Iraq are now supporting what they see as a Sunni insurgency in Syria. This is beginning to take on some sectarian elements, which I think could be very dangerous. And obviously, you know, some of the Sunni insurgents in Iraq in the past have been linked to certainly to extremist movements. But I think there are a lot of the protesters in Syria are simply advocating democracy. And I think it's a little bit dangerous to sort of make sweeping generalizations about who these protesters are. As far as Ambassador Ford's visit, that He was clearly impressed by the people with whom he met there. And, you know, that coincided with a much sharper turn on the part of the U.S. government. All of a sudden, after that visit, the U.S. State Department, U.S. government became much more critical of Assad. So that it seemed to have had some impact.
And now you've got a threat against the U.S. ambassador, the French ambassador, not to leave Syria. They're sort of being cordoned off, Moises.
Indeed. Ambassador Robert Ford and also the French ambassador to Syria, Eric Chevalier, have been ordered not to travel 25 kilometers outside Damascus, to stay there. The embassies were also attacked when it was known that they had visited these cities that are where there's a lot of violence. And there is two surprises about Syria is how such a closed country for information is leaking so much information. And that is through all sorts of citizen journalists that are sending videos and done with their cell phones. So there is a lot of information that shows that this is large, that it has been persistent. The other surprise is the resilience of the protesters. This has been now going on for months, in which people take to the streets and they are shot at.
And they know that.
And they know that, and they still take to the streets. And every Friday and more, there are people that are killed, very often by the government. And so that's quite surprising. And so there's more going on there than what Ibrahim suggests, that it's just simply a population captured by extremists.
The other thing I would add is that I don't think it's that surprising that the administration took this turn finally to criticize the leadership in Syria, because it was under a lot of criticism itself for having a very confused policy where it was demanding that Gaddafi leave Libya, but was being very holding back on President Assad in Syria. And it finally now there's some consistency, although obviously Syria is not like Libya and there's no movement whatsoever for any kind of military action.
Let's talk about Libya for a moment. What's the latest on the rebels' march on Tripoli? Are they making any progress? What is Gaddafi saying, Moises?
What we know is that last weekend there was a three-hour meeting between three senior American diplomats with four senior representatives of Gaddafi to discuss what next steps. That meeting has been portrayed differently. The Americans said that the central and only message is Gaddafi has to leave, and the Libyans instead reported the meeting as saying, we exchanged views and explained how to repair a relationship that has been damaged by misinformation. But the story is that there is the rebels are making advances, that there are all sorts of rumors and actually hard information about shortages of supplies and weapons for the Gaddafi forces. And the biggest news of it all is that the United States and others have released the money and the funds to the transitional authority, the rebel government, who now has access to literally billions of dollars. And that can be a game changer.
Yeah, but Diane, I think that we have to say that the rebels have not been all that impressive. I mean, they have plenty of money, they have plenty of weapons. They have not been able to, and they're up against an enemy in the Gaddafi regime, which is disorganized, demoralized, opposed by basically the whole world, and yet this is largely a stalemate. I mean, they're fighting over places like Brega, where they've been fighting from the beginning. You know, they're not really making, they keep saying they're moving on Tripoli. They haven't gotten anywhere close to Tripoli yet. So, you know, I think this is unlikely to end with a clear-cut military triumph.
Could Gaddafi remain in Libya if he stepped down?
Well, the French are suggesting that he do precisely that. I think that the, I think his personal security would be in great jeopardy if he remained in Libya. I mean, the rebels are out to make sure that he gets killed. And the consequence of his security being endangered is he's going to want to surround himself with a security force to protect him, which means basically that he'll still be in power, albeit in perhaps a more isolated kind of way. But that does not sound like a very promising solution to this.
All right, to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Nick. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning. How are you all doing?
Good.
So my question is in response to the comments you all made about Pakistan. Pakistan has a woeful history of responding to American policy, whether it's foreign aid, intelligence, military, et cetera. But yet on the same, on the same page, America has not always kept its promises to Pakistan. They've pulled out a number of times, and we seem to have this reactive foreign policy to a really volatile area, you know, the world. So I'm curious, what do you think is going to happen down the street? Are we going to, you know, toe the rope, stay in for the long haul, and really make, you know, integrated changes in, into the country? Because all we're doing now is reacting to, I think, a compartmentalized country. You know, you have some people making rules, some people is responding to rules. You know, people, you know, you made the comment about the donations to the political parties, et cetera. And I'm kind of curious what you think about this geometrical kind of view instead of just compartmentalized view of foreign policy, which has kind of dominated American foreign policy, I think, in toto. So I'm kind of curious what you all think. And
all right. Thanks for calling, Elizabeth.
Well, I don't have a good answer to that. I think if we repeatedly ask, you know, military commanders and State Department officials, American policymakers, where is this going? What happens next? And you get answers that are, well, we're working on it. We're still talking. It's better to talk than not to talk. The Pakistani government is, I can't do better than that. The Pakistani government, the civilian government, is extremely weak. The military runs the show there still. I think there's been questions about how long that government can survive. So I don't have a really good answer for you other than that Pakistan is far more critical right now, even than Afghanistan. I mean, anybody in the military will tell you that is the really serious problem is Pakistan, that the al-Qaeda is, there's still important leaders there, and that the al-Qaeda in Afghanistan is down to 50 to 100 low-level fighters, you know. And so that, until that is resolved, if it ever is, with getting rid of al-Qaeda in Pakistan, I don't see any, the U.S. will have to engage with Pakistan.
Elizabeth Miller of the New York Times, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show, to Columbia, Missouri. Good morning, Anne.
Hi. I am so envious of the people that have protested, like in Syria and Egypt. And, you know, it's really, they all got together and protested, and I just wish I had the way to go to the Capitol and protest about what's going on in the United States, and I wish, you know, like a million of us would go there and protest about what's going on. And I sometimes feel like we're just so tired. You know, the American people are just so tired, and I'm wondering if it would work.
Tom,
if we protested.
Well, I'm not sure what Anne wants to protest against. We had a quite
about everything.
Everything, okay, Anne. Well, yeah. We had a very energetic protest in 2010 that resulted in the election of 87 new members of Congress and a Tea Party movement that is, in some ways, I think you'd have to acknowledge that this is sort of the U.S. version of some of these protest movements. I mean, very energetic, very angry, very determined. You know, the ideas, you know, you can debate the ideas, but this, I think, you know, was a type of protest movement. And if that's what Anne has in mind, you know, boy, the Tea Parties don't seem tired to me. They seem quite energized.
They surely are. Any comment, Moises?
There is widespread agreement that the Tea Party was energized by the support of Fox News. There is no doubt that the Tea Party captured a sentiment in the United States and among the people like Anne and others. But there is that's true. But it is also true that that sentiment was amplified and energized by the intensity of the coverage and even the promotion that it got from Rupert Murdoch's Fox News. So in many ways, we can connect the two big stories of this week, the debt ceiling negotiations that have been where the Tea Party caucus played a very important role in shaping those negotiations and what was happening in London with the Rupert Murdoch hearings.
And you're saying, if I understand you correctly, that primarily the Conservative Tea Party members had great support from Fox News.
Yeah, I think it is undoubted that there was a clear enthusiasm and active promotion and coverage and stimulating the meetings and energizing what was a legitimate movement. And there was, as I said, the Tea Party did capture a sentiment in the country that was amplified and energized by Fox News.
Didn't the New York Times cover the Tea Party? Didn't NPR cover the Tea Party in exactly the same way?
Well, of course the New York Times covered the Tea Party extensively. I can't really speak to the Fox News coverage. I didn't see a lot of it, but that's about all I can say.
All right,
I think
Tom,
that Ms. Moises' point is that there's, you know, a lot of opinion leaders appearing on Fox News who were, in fact, promoting this this point of view. I'd like to say that both the New York Times and NPR are less opinionated in their approach to news coverage than Fox generally
Tom
has been.
Tom Gelton of NPR, Elizabeth Buhmiller of the New York Times, Moises Naim of El País, thank you all so much.
I will
be on vacation next week. My colleague Susan Page will be sitting in this chair. I'll be back with you, God willing, a week from Monday. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Ring.